You're listening to the Valley College Connection podcast, where John Kawai and Scott Wiegand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to be where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Los Angeles Valley College. John and Scott believe that all of us and the college itself are a work in progress. And in this podcast, they'll explore on a more personal level how the community can work together to support each other as we move forward with our goals.
We are joined today by Dr. Darby Southgate, professor of sociology here at Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much for being here today, Darby.
What a pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me.
We wanted to start off by just taking a look backwards and digging into your story and your path, your journey that brought you here to Valley College. And so please take some time to share with us as far back as you'd like to go, but certainly highlight, you know, your family, your high school, your college, graduate school experiences, everything that brought you to be here at Valley.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Again, thank you for this opportunity to share my journey and sort of where I'm going and where I want to be going. I guess my path started in Canada, where I was born in Toronto. And when I was 4 years old, my parents, who were both immigrants to Toronto, my mother was from Germany, my father was from Northern England, they moved out here to California, Los Angeles, in 1969. That weekend was the weekend what's the big hippie festival? Oh, my God.
Woodstock?
Woodstock. Thank you so much. Wow, I just went, like, mind dead on that one. Yeah, Woodstock. So as we were driving from Toronto out to Los Angeles, I just remember being 4 years old and just feeling that everybody in America was beautiful because it seemed like everybody was a hippie. So I think that was, like, a galvanizing moment for me. When I got to California, I was a huge fan of music. My father played bagpipes. My mother played mandolin. And so we moved to Lawndale. And I went to a series of schools in Torrance. Ultimately, we landed in Torrance. Torrance was a great school district for me, so I got a lot of guidance in terms of my academic preparation. Luckily, I was noticed for being a little bit intelligent, so they put me in advanced placement classes. I look back now and I realize what an amazing trajectory that was, because had I not been advanced placement, I don't think I would have had the same level of education that I had. Now, given my parents are from Europe, so when I would go home at night, we would read for fun. I remember my very first book was The Jungle Book. I read that at 4, not the movie, but the book.
Right.
So that trajectory ultimately was starting to prepare me for college. In high school, I literally fell in love with music. I was a member of different choirs. I started a jazz ensemble that ultimately I got funding for, got my professor, I'm sorry, my she was a teacher. Wow, so similar. Got her to hire a bass player and to buy keyboards.
Wow.
And And while I was in high school, I had taken an electronic music course, and Bob Moog had come into our class as a guest lecturer. So I got deeply involved in electronic music and synthesizers back in the 80s, and we incorporated all of that in my high school.
Wow. Now, the advanced placement that you were put into, did that happen at the high school level, or is that junior high, or when did that start?
It was at high school.
At high school.
Yeah,
okay.
Junior high. I was at Torrance Elementary for my elementary program. Then I went to a middle school, Hull. And that's where I started doing choruses, but it wasn't until high school that I really got the liberty to sort of expand out and do more things on campus. The advanced placement program I was a part of was some new program they were starting, and I can't remember what the initials stood for, but it was IPI, Independent Placement Something. And they literally had blocked classes, and they would tell us that we would have to take an English class, but we'd only have to take it twice a week. So the other three or four days, depending on what course we were having to take, we were allowed just to hang out in this area where all of us scholar kids got to hang out, and we would develop ideas and projects. And that's where I started developing the musical program. So even today, Torrance High is known for its jazz program, and they win awards, and I feel like that's certainly part of my legacy.
Right.
Yeah, so when I got out of high school, my parents, being immigrants, said I should go to Cal State Long Beach because my sister had started there, and they didn't want me to major in music because they needed me to actually make a living, and they felt that music wasn't something that was actually reasonable to do in college.
And just one sibling? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, one sibling, my sister. Yeah, okay. She was an accountant, so I wanted to become a marketing major. I had a sense that I really liked people and was really curious about human behavior.
Yeah.
So I went to I had purple hair at the time. I was really interested in alternative lifestyles, and I don't know if anyone's ever heard of the rainbow people, but we had what Burning Man is today was started in the 1980s, and some interesting groups of people I was hanging out with. And I went to a marketing class, and it was impacted, meaning there was not enough room for people to actually declare the major. So I sat in the classroom with my purple hair, and I noticed that nobody would sit on either side of me. And but there was people standing in the classroom. So I had that realization, right, that even if I make it out of this program, I'm not going to make it in the business world.
Right.
Nobody's going to hire somebody who's pierced up in 1980 with purple hair and just a different view of life.
That's an interesting observation to make just from day one of the class, to sort of be able to sit back and sort of see, based on the people around you, hey, this is probably not the right fit for me.
That's it. And again, I don't know that anybody has a catalog of every possible opportunity at a college. So oftentimes we expect you to sort of know what you want to do and who you are and where you want to go, but we don't know that because there isn't that sort of that catalog that we get when we come to a campus. So I ended up looking, this is back in paper before we had computers, and I started looking through the course catalog to find something else that just fit that time. I just needed to not be out of a class, as so many of our students know, right? We have to make sure that our schedules are full and, financial aid implications and all that. So I found this class called Social Stratification, which was in the sociology department. I showed up the first day late, obviously, because I was in the marketing class, and I sat down and the professor was asking everybody to do a 100-question quiz to sort of gauge where the class was.
Wow.
Day one, right? It's like, I didn't even study. I don't even know what to do. The questions were amazing. She was asking questions about Woody Guthrie. Well, of course, I knew who Woody Guthrie was. I was working with a folk music band at the time. I was doing labor music. She asked if we knew who Karl Marx was. I'm like, of course I knew who Karl Marx was. I was reading Hegel at the time, and Hegel was the father of dialectics. And he was, him and Karl have this wonderful dialogue through the literature. And it was just every single question. She asked, what social class are you? Everybody in my class said middle class. I said working class. Mm-hmm. It was just like this amazing fit. I didn't feel alone. Nobody was judging me for my purple hair. In fact, she thought it was fantastic that I was breaking some of the norms. Fast forward, I ended up through my career becoming a stratification expert. That's what I got my doctorate in.
Oh, wow.
Right.
So explain what that is.
Right. The doctorate?
No, the stratification.
Stratification, yeah, good answer. Stratification is how societies rank, categorize and rank groups of people. So in our society, three major characteristics of stratification are race, class, and gender, right? So generally, certain groups of people are given more privileges and opportunities, and other groups of people are given less opportunities and privileges. So here in America, we often think that we live in a society of a meritocracy, that if we all just work hard, we can do whatever we want to be or do whatever we want to do. But I always use this example in my class, how many female presidents have we had? And the fact that we don't have a female president, is it because women just aren't working hard enough? Right? Obviously, that cannot be the answer. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested even in today, are sort of power dimensions, who has power. And so when I graduated from Cal State Long Beach, again, my parents were not supportive of my academics in anything other than something that I could monetize, something to get me a job. So I went to Dominguez Hills, and I got a position working at a research center. So under the mentorship of Robert Christie, he ran a center called the Center for Urban Research and Learning. I became a co-principal investigator for a series of large-scale social studies. So we did things like work for the Department of Health. We worked for the city of Carson. And that's where I really got my analysis skills.
Mm. So you graduated Cal State Long Beach with a bachelor's degree in sociology?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
That's
and then
right.
Directly from there, you started working at Cal State Dominguez.
And got accepted there and went there thinking that I was going to get a master's degree and then work. Because, again, I'm a working class girl. Everybody in my family said, you just need to work.
And where was music in your life at this point?
I was just playing on the side. I was currently, at that time, I was hanging out with a really dear friend of mine named Shorty B, who just recently put out, you've heard of the film Black Panther? Mm-hmm. The first song that when you go to the movie theater and watch that film, it's an artist by the name of Too Short. And Shorty B's his producer and bass player, and Shorty B's rather infamous and a really fantastic music producer. So I was hanging out with him at the time. I was up in the studio in North Hollywood, just hanging out, having fun, playing music as a hobby instead of pursuing it as an actual career.
And then how did you make these relationships at that time?
I've always played music. At 14 years old, I would, kids don't do this. At 14 years old, I would sneak into clubs and hang out with musicians. And my parents are European and very, very strict. So I was quote unquote a good girl. And I would just hang out and listen to the music. And some of the guys in the bands would let me hang out if I would do things like tune their guitar or change their strings. And I ended up kind of being like this little kid that hung out with a lot of these really, really talented musicians. And I never let go of that.
Yeah. And your parents, you said, were both musicians.
They were.
So were you playing with them in the house, or were they playing sort of, you know, as a family? Or
yeah, you know, we did. Early in my early years, Christmas time was always incredibly musical. My mom had bought us one of those little Magnum organs that we could just, you know, sort of play in the morning before school or after school. But unfortunately, my dad never played bagpipes in the home once we moved away from Canada here to America. I think a lot of this was sort of these lost dreams, right? And I think for parents, they don't want to see their children sort of make the same mistakes that they did and not seeing a pathway to make money and be okay and be secure. And my mom definitely didn't want me just to get married and be a wife, because that's, I mean, no offense to wives everywhere, but that's not exactly a success story.
Right.
So they wanted something better for me.
Right.
And so I still managed a way to figure out how to continue being in music, though not using it as a career path.
So you're hanging out with Shorty B. You're at Cal State Dominguez, started the master's program there and working there.
Yeah.
Juggling. Okay. So what's the master's program like there? How did that go for you?
The master's program was fantastic because there wasn't a lot of students that wanted to do a dissertation or a thesis. They really just wanted to take, there's a test you can take or you can do a thesis. So I decided to go ahead and try the writing, right, which would actually ask me to do an analysis. Now, when you get to your master's program, this is where they're teaching you how to do these different sort of ways of analysis. And again, I had a feeling that if I'm going to spend 2 years studying a topic, it would have to be something I'm interested in. So I decided to look at genres of music.
Here's the crossover, right? Formally. Cool.
Yeah, okay. That's it. So my thesis was called Music Boxes, the Commodification of Music Genres. So what I was really interested in looking at was in the sociological literature, we distinguish two different pathways of any type of culture. One is the consumption of culture, people consuming it, listening to it, and then there's producers. I was really interested in where those two intersect. Being at the studio watching people like Too Short, Shorty B, I mean, these are just such great musicians. The receptionist of the studio was one of Rick James's Mary Jane girls. We were just inundated with this amazing amount of music, but the music that was coming out of that studio was West Coast gangster rap. Yet when we're listening to music, we're listening to George Clinton, Funkadelic, and I wanted to sort of look at how that happened. And in that thesis, I realized that there's a couple of different pathways. Musicians create categories, but so do the media. And so that was where I really started noticing the commodification. Commodification means how we take something and then turn it into a product that can be monetized, bought, and sold. So that's really where the next step for me was just looking at the sociological implications of music and what that means.
Right.
At the end of the day, if you're a really great musician today, that doesn't really matter. It's what station can they play you on? Where can they market you? A lot of great people out there don't ever do anything successfully with their music because they just don't fit neatly into one of those music boxes.
Right.
So that was my interest for my master's degree.
Well, do you find that more less of an issue now, or is it just as much of an issue? Because it feels like in the 80s we had a set number of radio stations and each radio station had a brand. And now that we have internet and YouTube, is it different, or is there just no more money in music now just because everyone just steals?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues with that. I would say that even more than radio stations, it's really the concentration of the ownership of the media themselves, right? So there's the really famous book by a scholar named Negus, N-E-G-U-S, and he looks at markets within musical production. And as we see the owners becoming fewer and fewer, so like back in the 1960s and 70s, there were hundreds of people that owned different music labels. So if you had a great idea, you were just a cool band, you could get signed, they'd promote you, they'd push you out there, they'd pay for your hotel rooms, and you'd kind of do whatever you did. If they made money, that's great. Everybody was sort of in it for the fun. Today, we only have a couple of ownerships. In fact, 90% of all music and entertainment in America is channeled through only 5 mega corporations. So within those corporations, they leverage their performers, right? So you've got someone, you know, on a radio station that they own, they're in a commercial that they own, they're pushing products that they own. There's no way that anyone's going to be able to break through that. So the internet provides us opportunities like the Arctic Monkeys, right? Where we can actually go directly to your audience. But the problem with that is the audience themselves aren't necessarily educated. So they might just like one type of music. So if you play country music and hip hop, what's your audience going to do? Mm-hmm. Right? So that, I think for me, that's the more interesting question is, how does our audience anticipate the music? Are they okay with you playing slow jazz and then the next song doing hip hop and then the next song country? That's the more interesting part. Why are people compartmentalizing the music? Can't we just listen to it and enjoy it?
Well, I remember growing up in the 80s and having a very strong association with identity and music.
Yeah.
That it was part of who we were, and we didn't listen to certain genres because that's someone else.
Right.
There was a tribal identity.
Yeah.
So I know the challenge I always ask my students now is, name a new genre of music that defines your generation.
Mm.
And they can't. Yeah. When I think of my generation, we had new wave, we had rap, we had fusion. We had every sort of decade has its genre that defines it. And is it the corporatization, you think, that has kept us from having these new genres that break out? Or is it the fact that students are, not students, but people no longer buy music?
I think there's a lot of social implications of this. I think people don't buy music. The only group of people that are really still purchasing music are country music fans. So we see this tendency for musicians to kind of move over to country. I think the identity music, there's another scholar from Vanderbilt, Pete Peterson, he's no longer with us, but he was a very famous sociologist of sociology of music, particularly music scenes. And he said that back in the day, we would only consume a certain type of music, which is your identity politic, right? I'm a punk rocker, I don't listen to hip hop.
Right.
I'm a rapper, I don't listen to whatever. He says that we have become in modern time omnivores, that we can consume different types of music. So you can look up Rigoletto today. You can go and watch an opera, because if you have access to the computer.
Right.
But do you identify as an opera fan? Probably not. So I think music itself has become less important in terms of helping us form identities and communicating with one another, where that was the reason we would communicate. Remember in the 1980s, I was around. How else would you find people? How do you find the cool chicks and dudes you want to hang out with?
Right.
You'd have to go to the shows.
Right, right. Or there would be those markers, those identifiers, signifiers, that metal shirt or that flannel,
right,
or whatever it was, the purple hair.
My purple hair.
Right.
That's right. My dreadlocks
right.
today. I'm still
yeah.
signaling. I'm still right. signaling that I'm not a mall shopper. And I think
right.
that's part of it. So when I go into a concert, I don't just go and hang out with the group. I go backstage and talk to the musicians. I look at the gear.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I don't identify as a consumer. I still identify as a producer. So I think that is a big part of the music change within our society. It functions differently.
Fascinating.
I could sit here all day and just talk to you about music.
Well, as we move forward here, I think we'll continue to see the thread that runs through your story.
Indeed.
So we're in the story where you're at Cal State Dominguez,
correct,
master's program,
correct,
playing music,
yeah,
working on your dissertation. That was really looking at the genres of music.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you finish up that dissertation.
Yeah.
And then where are you at?
I was I had realized that if the research process itself is very difficult. In fact, math, right? This is part of the struggle for many of us working class kids. We don't necessarily have a really good training in how to do analysis, statistics, all these sorts of tools that we need. So I was struggling, and I realized that I needed to train myself because I couldn't count on my public education to do that. So I had written this thesis that I was about ready to publish for my master's thesis defense, and I had heard that there was a mini culture conference. So the American Sociological Association is sort of the larger professional association for sociologists, and all they were studying was music. And I thought, oh, this is it. These are the people I need to meet, because all I care about is sociology of music. I don't care if I can't make money, mom and dad. I just need to study something I'm interested in. So I went to this conference, and I ended up talking to a lot of famous sociologists. Mm. And one of the people I met was a man named Vincent Rashinio. And he does a little bit of sociology of music. Long story short, he ended up asking me to be part of Ohio State University.
Okay.
So even though I was in my 40s and I didn't test incredibly high on my GRE, he saw my scholarship and noticed my interest and realized that I would be a good fit for the program.
Okay, can I interrupt mm-hmm. you for just sort
yeah,
of pause you out
do.
There for a second?
Yeah.
I think you made a really interesting statement, and I think an insight that you had then as a graduate student who had finished the dissertation, to come to the realization that, hey, wait a second, I don't necessarily have the skills or the sort of analytical skills that I'd like to have or I need to have.
Right.
I think for a lot of folks after finishing a master's program, that there's perhaps a level of sometimes, you know, false confidence that, okay, now I have my master's degree, I'm ready to go. But, you know, the flip side is perhaps just as true more often than not that, it, you know, the more you know, the less you know.
That's
and
it.
So you sort of had that insight, like, hey, there's something else. But you had the fortitude to seek something out. And lo and behold, there's this conference.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So after the conference, I went to the next, we have a general conference for the American Sociological Association, and I decided to take a logistic regression course. Again, I've never taken calculus, but I knew that that was going to be the next step in my education as a sociological analyst. So I went ahead and bought the $300-something class. Again, I am a working class kid, but I knew how important that was. In the middle of that workshop, I was lost, confused, defeated, felt like I was stupid. What the heck was I doing? I just threw away $350. And I left about 15, 20 minutes before the workshop was over, and I ended up running into Vinny Rashinio at the conference.
Ah.
And he was standing next to Tom Dowd and Tia DeNora. And I forgot who the other person was.
Calmed out. Okay.
These are all sociologists and all sociology of music people. So it turned into one of those moments of my tribe found me.
Okay.
Right? And the fact that I was making the effort, no matter where I was willing to bridge the gap.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So even I got accepted at Ohio State, their focus is stratification. So here I am, the class that changed my life. I could talk about Woody Guthrie. I could talk about the ranking groups of people. And more importantly, I could talk about production and consumption of music within that framework. So I found my home. I went to Ohio State, which that was crazy, going to the Midwest for 7 years. I counted it by winters, right? I'm from California. I'm not even used to that. But the best part of that was there wasn't a lot for me to do. I don't drink, and it's a real bar culture out there.
Okay.
So I was literally reading, writing, and then playing, of course, because without music, I go crazy. So that was the grounding force.
And were you part of the music scene in Ohio?
You know, I ended up being part of a labor band with my mentor, Vincent Rashinio, and two of our graduate students, Jill and her husband, and of course another faculty member. And we did Woody Guthrie music. We did music from the 1932 just labor movement. So that was really the most that I did, because I was writing a book and a dissertation and taking courses in advanced calculus. So I was inundated, right? I couldn't really do music out at the same level that I can here. And to be honest, I met a lot of really famous musicians in Ohio, but it is a very different music scene than it is here.
Right.
Right? The funk was born in Ohio. So I'd go down to Dayton and Cincinnati, you know, Bootsy's from there, Rick James, of course, was at the record company. But this is a very different scene, right? Older people know each other for generations, whereas here you can kind of go to shows and just kind of talk to people. So I didn't really do a lot except for like acoustic music out there, which I could fit in on the weekend in between my studies, but that was it. I was really focusing on getting my dissertation and getting the heck out of there.
And you said your 7 years there.
I did. Seven years
for the PhD program there.
Yeah.
And you'd mentioned that, you know, as you left that $300 class that you'd paid for it and you'd felt defeated and then found your tribe. What was your experience like at Ohio State as you were taking those advanced calculus classes? Did you feel once you were there that I'm supposed to be here, that I have the support that I need? Or were there still moments or times where you doubted yourself or your place there or what your trajectory was going to be like at that point?
Yeah, I definitely doubted myself. I feel like maybe 60% or more of my cohort did not make it.
Wow.
Right? Two B minuses and you get kicked out because it's graduate program. So it's serious. They always talk about being a big fish in a small pond, right? And then when you get to graduate school, you're the small fish in a big pond. I definitely felt that. I was competing, and I hate to use the word competition because at Ohio State, they funded all of their graduate students in the sociology department.
Wow.
Right. So there wasn't, because they really take stratification seriously. They understand that many of us have potential, but because of our financial frailty or insecurities that we're not able to reach our full potential. So they funded all of us. But I didn't have the skill set. I didn't come from a liberal arts college. They talk differently than I do. I'm talking to musicians all day long. I'm not used to using words like erudite. What the heck does erudite mean? And how can you judge me the way I look if I'm smart? So I grappled with all that insecurity.
Right.
What I ended up doing was finding a group of older women like myself, and we would hire a math tutor to come in, tutor one of us, because again, we're all poor, we can't afford this. And then that woman would bring it back to the group.
Ah.
And so for 2 years, literally, we helped each other through the program.
Right, right. Wow, support group.
Big time.
Supports of community.
That's it.
Yeah.
And again, women power. There's something about that, right? Not that guys are great, but there's just something about women struggling through math that we were really, really good support for one another. And also reminding ourselves, validating ourselves that we do deserve to be here.
Right.
That our voices are important, right? If we just keep looking at the same six people to come up with the same six answers, that's not going to change society. We need to bring in more of an inclusive voice and talk to people like us, because we're the ones that are facing sort of the stuff of the world. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was the most difficult, maybe, stuff I've ever done in my life. Trying to keep it together, not lose my mind, feel defeated, and just go, oh, well, I've got a master's degree, I can get a job.
Right.
Because that's all my parents wanted, was the security. They never saw anything coming out of a PhD aside from you can get paid more.
Okay.
Right? Because we're not reading scientific journals. We're not in the conversation. We didn't go to liberal arts schools.
Yeah.
Right? So it's really alienating.
So would you say that your parents were not supportive of the PhD program or ambivalent or already satisfied that you had a master's and were pursuing more education?
I think they were proud of me because I got accepted, right? This chick with purple hair that they kind of wrote off as she'd probably get married and pregnant and be done. And that's not what happened. So I think they were more amazed and surprised.
Right.
And
right.
Proud. But again, it's a real sort of esoteric, I'm proud. What does it mean? When is she going to do something awesome? So I did. I ended up buying a house, moving them into my house, taking care of them until the day they died. Like, I won, right? I won. I figured all that stuff out.
Yeah.
So when I wrote the book, they were my first book. They saw my name on the cover, and it was just tears and joy. And
oh, wow.
Right.
What a moment that must have been. So you're 7 years into the program. You write your dissertation. Is the dissertation and the book done at the same time, or is one complementary to the other? How did that look?
I did them at the same time. One of my mentors, Lisa Keister, she's at Duke, very fantastic sociologist. She said, we should write a book on stratification. I said, yeah, let's do it. So we did a book on stratification. So that was published with Cambridge University Press, which, again, my parents thought, well, we know that.
Yeah, right, right.
You're still weird, but we get that. So that year was pretty crazy. I was writing a book and my dissertation. I kid you not, 10 to 12-hour writing. I would start something like a sandwich at 10 o'clock in the morning, and by 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd notice only part of the sandwich was left.
Wow.
It was really bad. It wasn't healthy.
Yeah.
Right? It
yeah.
just wasn't healthy. But I understood that that's what I needed to do. I'm not one of those people that could write for 6 hours then live the rest of the day. I needed to focus. So I wrote a cross-national analysis of 41 countries for my dissertation, which was all using sort of advanced level calculus. And then I did a book on stratification, which allowed me to survey everything that we were doing in that sort of in that discipline, in the topic.
What was the name? What's the name of your book?
My book is called Stratification, Race, a Contemporary Approach to Race, Class, and Gender.
Wow.
And it's filled with awesome analyses. Sexy, sexy analysis.
Wow.
So what happened after Ohio State?
After Ohio State, both my parents were very ill, and I was really taking care of my mom. She was a heart patient for about 15 years. She was born in Berlin and lived through World War II. So she had a whole host of health issues. So I needed to come back to L.A. I'd been given a couple of job opportunities back east, upstate New York. And while those sounded fantastic, I really needed to come back to L.A. I had a house here. I have a family here. And I got some of the coolest friends you could ever find here. So I was just on the job market. I moved back here. I worked at Los Angeles Unified School District for a couple of years as an analyst, which I had done periodically while I was at graduate school, because I had also worked there prior. And went on the job market, and luckily Los Angeles Valley College hired me, so I got to stay here in L.A.
What year was that?
2010. Yeah, 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been here 8 years. Very, very happy.
Time flies.
Oh, so we got hired at the same time.
Yeah.
Same year?
Same 2000. Year.
Wow, you were part of that same sort of
mass
hiring cohort.
That's okay. Right. That's right.
And after I got hired, and 8 years later, the people in my department said, we weren't sure if we were going to keep all of you because the recession had hit.
I remember that.
And we had hired a whole lot of people that we thought we couldn't afford, and
yep. We
just barely got in.
That's it. And In fact, I remember some of the hostility at some of the – I was the Educational Planning Committee chair, right, the EPC chair, and I remember some of the hostility. I mean, I love our administrators as people, right? But as a power dimension, I remember over and over hearing that same thing, that you don't know that you have a job, right? And I think for many people, they don't understand tenure. They think that tenure is this sort of golden ticket. But as academics, we're literally only hired for a year as a contract, and it's literally a 10-month contract. Right. So unless you're actually contracted with tenure, we don't know that we have a job. Right, so that was one of the big issues here on campus, was that we just hired so many new faculty, and many of us were still looking for jobs just in case this didn't work out.
Yeah, I kept my Cal State LA part-time job 7 years until I finally felt confident that I'm okay.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I kept putting out job applications just in case. And I had a lot of callbacks, and every time they said, hey, do you want to? I'm like, maybe next year.
keep my record on file.
Exactly. which is horrendous, because at the end of the day, what we do in the classroom is really important. And when we're feeling insecure,
right. That
just, how can I tell a student everything's going to be great, get your doctorate, be awesome, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even while I was at graduate school, I had the opportunity to do an article, a paper, an analysis. And I mean, I've been cited 170 times around the world for this article. Like, that is so, to see me doing something at that scale, I want to tell my students, you can do this too.
This is what's possible.
This is it.
This is within the realm of possibility.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it's probable.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I'll bet on that. You go to a good school, you put yourself into positions where you're adding the lessons instead of trying to remove the lessons. Right? Because so many, I had a friend that told me, well, C's make degrees. And I said, but I'm competing with you out in the world. Your C is competing with my 4.0 A, plus my extra classes and my tutoring.
Mm.
How are we equal?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I know I'm disadvantaged, but I've got to help bridge that gap.
Right.
So that's the stuff I'm telling my students is that's okay. The number one employer in this country is Walmart. If you don't take this seriously, and I get it, there's lots of reasons for us not to take it seriously. But if we don't take it seriously, where are your jobs?
Mm. Mm.
That's it.
Yeah.
And for me, I want to make sure that we're talking about sort of what your teaching style is. I am a firm believer in apprenticing students as scholars. I call them scholars. I help them prepare for graduate school here at Valley. Because the next, that transfer is only 2 more years.
Right.
That's not the next step.
Right.
That's only, right? That's just the next movement to the next step, which is graduate school.
So you're putting that forward or putting that out there for your students as they're here. Here's what graduate school looks like. We're preparing now for that.
That's it. And I introduced them to living sociologists in my classroom. We talked about them by name so that when they go to Berkeley, I currently have 8 students at Berkeley.
Wow.
Currently, right? So they have pictures with Burroway, this really famous sociologist. They sent me pictures of hanging out with him. And so it's more than just apprenticing them as scholars. I'm creating colleagues. They're hanging out with people that I love to hang out with. And it's like using the same band mentality of sneaking in backstage and hanging out and changing the strings. But now we're doing it in the scientific community. So I want us to occupy that space as well. Because again, this is an exclusionary club, right? For the majority of people that have doctorates, less than 8% of Americans hold a doctorate degree. If we start disaggregating or tearing that statistic by, tearing it apart by race, class, and gender, I guarantee the vast majority of those are not poor, are not women, are not people of color, right? So it's unless we can sort of break that power dimension, nothing's really going to change here.
Well, I think listening to your story, the other thing I think that is, that I also really believe in is that study what you love.
Yeah.
Like I have a PhD in video games. In movies. I mean, you know, and when you're in telling your parents, like, what are your PhD in? Like, video games, movies? Now, right now, there's more money in video games than there are movies. But when I was doing it, people looked at me like, you can do that? Like, they don't actually call it that. But we all are sort of, everyone who's sort of into that, we're all sort of heading to the same place. There's a small number of places. They call it computer graphics. But at the end of the day, what it really is a whole bunch of Star Wars fans and people who love video games. And we're just meeting to say what's possible.
That's it.
Right?
That's it.
And I think that it's hard to discount enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Right? That thing where even if you didn't pay me, I would still be on the web trying to figure out what's going on and just learning about it and watching videos. For you, it's listening to different kind of musics.
Yeah.
And you're going to have that conversation with musicians, whether you're a sociologist or not, but having that sort of framework gives you a deeper dialogue to have.
Yeah.
And the same thing with me is, you know, I'm going to care about the next movie or the next video game, but just having that background... Mm-hmm. Right? Allows me to monetize it.
Yeah, that's it. And I play Dark Souls, by the way. I'm a huge gamer. I love gaming. You kidding me? Totally love gaming.
It's funny now because the program I'm at, they now sell it as a video game, bachelor's and a PhD and stuff like that. But at the time, they called it something else. We sort of like whispered between ourselves that really we're here for video games.
That's it.
We'll tell people plane simulators.
Yeah.
It sounds more real.
It's legitimate. It's the legitimation of things, right? And then until things become monetized and become a commodity, the people, the powers to be don't really recognize it. And I love that, the passion. I've been called effervescent. Like that idea that's exactly right. If I'm not passionate about it, I don't want to do it. I've never gotten paid for my scholarship. You know, that's the other dirty little secret, right? We encourage people to come on and get that PhD. But at the end of the day, every single thing I've published, somebody else owns that copyright. So I'm only doing, this sounds crazy, I only do this for fun. This is what I'm doing for fun, just like with music. I never really wanted to monetize it because I felt that if I started monetizing it, I'd dread it.
Right.
And I'd have to do it. And it's the one thing I love more than anything in the world, though I want to do that to the most precious thing. I just can't do that.
Right. But then if you have a scholarship in something that you love, you then get to meet people that you never thought you would meet and have conversations you would never get to have other way, like a hands-on.
Yeah. So that's my next step, right? So this is my next step. My article that looked at music looked at when students take music in school, when students have music lessons outside of school, and if parents take their children to concerts. And then I looked at different demographics, who has opportunities to take music. And as we could probably imagine, Asian and white students have more opportunities. And then does music actually affect reading and math? And yes, it does. So I did a quantitative analysis. And in my recommendation section, I suggested that we actually look at it qualitatively. What does this mean? In other words, what is the process by which participating in music affects math? So that's what I'm doing now. I'm designing a study. I'm going over to England this summer. And one of my favorite female composers is a woman named Delia Derbyshire, who I'm feeling like my dad actually named me after her. But yeah, a little bit of gossip. I'm excited to go over and see if I can't find anyone that's still alive that knew her and him. They lived in two of the same cities, and Derby is a town in England. And when I go over there, people always laugh at my name, but because it's a city. So they started a program, the Delia Derbyshire Day, and where they do intervention in math with children on electronic instruments.
Wow.
So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, I've contacted the director of that program, and I'm going to be looking at a series of different programs that are doing just that, looking at sort of whatever lesson delivery through music. One of my other friends, dear friends, Lonnie Marshall, he's a Grammy winner. He worked with all sorts of bands, Weapon of Choice, a really famous band, yeah. And then he worked also with Joe Strummer from The Clash, and he won a Grammy working with Joe. He works for the Grammy Foundation, and he also does lesson delivery via music. So that's my next step. As you said, I get the opportunity to talk to great musicians and sort of figure out what I can do to lend my analytic skills to understand the world a little bit more. I'm super excited for that.
That sounds like a project that's just perfect for your interest and your expertise.
Yeah.
With the analysis that you've done so far, mm-hmm. you mentioned the study that you were looking at. Was it looking at music for students in K through 12, the sort of exposure that they had? And what were you finding? I hear sort of anecdotally all the time. My sister teaches for LAUSD. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we hear all the time about how the music programs and the art programs are the first to sort of be cut.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sort of emphasis on STEM and you know, standardized testing and all these sort of things. What did your study tease out in terms of that?
Yeah, so that's exactly where I started the conversation. You know, when we do a literature review, we want to review all the literature that's out there. So I actually started with Pythagoras. Like the
took it way back.
Right. Well, that was my point. I was, you know, I think it's a little snarky looking back on it now, but I'm like trying to remind people that, oh yeah, like no, we know how important music is, right? I mean, if it wasn't for Pythagoras, we wouldn't have standardized tunings.
Right. So he's the one who created all the ratios of the strings.
That's it. Perfect four. Thank you. Right. All of these ideas and the Gallup poll. 98% of Americans believe that music is an important part of education. 97% of all kindergarten kids in America have music in the classroom. Music is an integral part of being human. So my study, I used two different data sets. I used early childhood, the ECLSK Early Childhood Longitudinal Study, which was published by the National Center for Education Statistics, and then NELS, which is high school, middle to high school, National Educational Longitudinal Study. And so I looked at both age groups to see what music does and also who has access to music. And again, that was the point. It's all the patterns that sociologists know, we see it reflected in music access. So things like, obviously, the more money a family has, resource-wise, the more likely they are to do certain things. But then there were some really interesting groups. Like, on average, African-American parents take their children to concerts more than non-African-Americans. Mm. Right? So as I'm going through some of these analyses, I'm thinking, what are they doing differently?
Right.
What are they doing differently? And then again, as an educator, if they're doing something differently, how can we get involved in that and help move us? Like, wouldn't it be wonderful if children that are in kindergarten aren't just clapping along to "This Land Is Your Land," but actually learn about Woody Guthrie and right. maybe learn how to count?
Right.
And you
right.
can do four counts and you can do two counts. How many two counts can you fit in a four count? And all of a sudden you're learning math.
Then you have the math lesson.
There
and
you go.
And it's contextualized and no longer abstract.
That's right. And it's fun.
Right.
Wouldn't
right.
that be amazing to make it fun? So that... Sociologically speaking, every single group that is disadvantaged in our society is disadvantaged in music, except for African American families.
Wow.
Fascinating. So here's an inroad for us to follow and see what can we do now. That's why I'm going to England, because I wanted to look at power minorities, not just ethnic minorities, but power minorities. And I wanted to see what were they doing over there and how does it look and how does it work? In other words, is the process and the mechanisms by which the education occurs the same, right? Because that's the interesting stuff.
Mm.
Music could just potentially be a delivery system by which we can get people engaged.
Mm, right,
yeah.
right. This sort of force that sort of cross-cultural
That's it.
Cuts across everything.
That's it. Yeah. And there's so much to bring up, right? Because, I mean, everything from the slave trade and the beautiful. I mean, one of my friends, Kamazi Brown, is a very famous ethnomusicologist. He's traced African sounds into modern-day hip-hop and did the full survey. So, you know, if you're African-American in our society, and I get it, we're not an inclusive society. What a great way to see yourself in the society, not be problematized. Because oftentimes when we talk about right. certain groups of people, we talk about the problem with that group of people.
Right.
This is a great way to sort of, you know, showcase the great American history. And the same in England, right? The fact that there's this Delia Derbyshire. She's a female in the 1950s who got a math degree at Cambridge University. I don't know how many females are doing that.
Right.
But it's
right.
through music that that happened.
Wow. That sounds like you have an amazing summer ahead of you.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
So if you had a student who wanted to follow your path,
mm-hmm.
okay, what advice would you give that student now?
Two things. I tell them all the time, you have to be passionate. I reckon my passion for sociology and music, like some people have for people they love, like their lover. If you can't wait to get out of class to text him or her, I can't wait to get out of class to go read an article. That passion, I can't instill how important that is. And the second part is don't expect people to give you the education you need. You go get that education. Sometimes I would sit for hours on the computer reading stuff. I joined groups, like small sample size scientist groups, just so I could be more versed in the rhetoric, the words, because I didn't have that. So I forced myself into those circles. I needed to have education that was deeper and more profound, and it just wasn't happening in the classroom for me.
And there's a level of agency, I think, and understanding that you can pursue that. And perhaps now with the technology that we have,
yeah.
which would make it easier as far as finding that and being able to sort of find those other groups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You both mentioned passion, and you were both talking about how your individual passion sort of led you down this particular road. What kind of advice would you have for students who, or for folks who say, you know, I'm not sure what I'm passionate about, that there isn't something that I've discovered that you know, I'm dying to do?
Yeah.
What do we do in those situations? How does one cultivate a passion?
You have to explore.
That's what I was going to say.
I mean, if you are walking the same street and meeting the same people,
mm-hmm.
then guess what? You haven't found it before, you're not going to find it again.
Yeah.
So I have this trouble with a lot of my friends, kids who are upper middle class, have every advantage except for passion. Super well skilled, but when you go, what is it that you care about? Like, I don't know, getting an A. I'm like, that's a terrible life.
Yeah.
So, you know, I usually tell them, is there a cause that you care about? Go volunteer mm-hmm. with people that you would never talk to, never have the opportunity. Be the place where you're the only high school student or the college student.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a conversation with someone's mom. I said, let's, where she has her daughter and she's trying to tell her, you got to work on your brag sheet. The conversation isn't about her brag sheet. The conversation is, we gotta find something you care about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if you don't know what makes you happy, no one can give it to you. So what are the small museums around your house? Go volunteer there. And I've had really great conversations with students who went to a small museum, and they were scanning images from refugee kids, just paintings, to make a global database. And because it's a small museum, they get to see all of it.
Right.
I've had other people where they have volunteered at the soup kitchen in downtown LA. And if you, when you see people struggle, you know, we're all empathetic creatures. It draws out a question of why and what can my part be. You have a better question to ask when you go to college. So at a certain point, you know, I tell high school students all the time, there should be something in your life that's unique, that you pick, where you're the only high school student there. And if you're the only high school student there, people will treat you pretty well because you're unique there. But if you're just one of a crowd that gets pushed in every semester, the people who are at whatever company or whatever it is, they're not going to see you. You're just another person who's just going to push on 6 months and someone will replace you.
Yeah. There's a really famous philosopher, Schopenhauer, and he talks about that, the cultivation of the self. And I'm such a geek. At 12 years old, I was reading philosophy. And like I said, I loved Hegel. What 12-year-old's reading Hegel, right? It's just crazy. But he instilled in me this idea that this was my life to live. And even though I was under the guise of my family, and again, they really didn't support my musical interest, which, you know, maybe it worked out for the best, I understood that I had to cultivate myself. So one of the questions I ask in my class every start of the semester is, what hobbies do you have? Mm-hmm. And in the last 20 years that I've been teaching, I've literally seen fewer and fewer students have a hobby.
Right.
So this is the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Because at the end of the day, we can tell you to go to a museum, but unless you understand music or you understand art, it's really just a bunch of naked statues.
Right?
So there's got to be something else.
There's got to be.
And that's that part of that self-cultivation. I was fortunate to be in a house of music. I was fortunate to be raised in that European household where we read. Mm. So for me, I sort of did it on my own. But what if we don't have those opportunities or resources at home?
Right.
That's the challenge. Yeah.
And perhaps the other factor that's leading to this group of students or this generation with fewer hobbies is this constant push of what's actually going to be a viable, you know, area of study.
That's it.
For you need to major in this because you're going to make that type of money regardless of what you're passionate about. The narrative that your parents were telling
you. That's it. And they did the right thing, right? Because at the end of the day, I'm single. Thank you very much. I want to stay single. I love men, but I'm not willing to live with one. I'm in the top 1% of my earning bracket for a single woman of my age. I won capitalism.
Right?
I own my own house. I'm secure. I've got a ridiculous number of instruments that I get to play with at home. I'm happy.
Right.
There's not a lot of people out there that are happy. They're just sort of doing it.
Right.
But remember, the data that people will give you about this is a good major or that's a good major, talk about the average person. On average, this person does okay. And if you say, well, then I won't be average. Mm-hmm. At whatever that thing I really care about, it's going to be great.
Right.
Right? So, you know, before I'd come here, I'd worked on movies. There's probably more people in the NBA than had my job working, researching on special effects in movies. Now, every person in my department has that job. Mm. So if you say, how many are there? Fewer than people that play in the NBA. Who made it? Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right? So at a certain point, if you just really care that this is a passion and this is just something we're going to constantly be working at, you make it. In fact, we all made it.
Right, but I was going to say, pardon me for interrupting, but I think one of the other issues was I found sociology only because I hated marketing.
Hmm.
Right? And I understand, right,
it's
right.
Very much of the dialectic there,
but,
right?
Man, Hegel's like smiling on me. I told you so. This is going to work out for you, kiddo. I think there's something to that. And again, as I understand, community colleges particularly are focusing students to get on a pathway, to figure out the job. You know, if you go to a liberal arts college, you can't major in something that is a job. You can't major in business at a liberal arts college, but they do just fine. So I'm a big proponent of trying out everything. You might be the most amazing sculptress, but unless you got your hands on some clay, how are you going to know that?
Right.
So
right.
Our job, I feel even more so at a community college level, is to give our community members the opportunities to develop whatever bubbles up in them. I can't tell you how many people I've inspired to declare a sociology major who didn't know what they were doing, first generation college student, and ended up at a Research One school. I have two students that are partners at law firms now because of their sociology path.
Right.
They never saw themselves that way. They were looking for a job.
Right, right.
Not greatness. So this is the part of the signal that we need to disrupt. Mm. And I think we do that by being awesome and passionate ourselves.
that passion is definitely contagious. I mean, your story, as you've shared with us today, is inspiring and contagious.
Aw, thanks.
I want to say one last kind of thread, I think, between what both of you touched on that I'm fascinated by and we've talked about in previous podcasts is this value or this understanding of the amount of work that goes into this type of success and being passionate. And perhaps sometimes the word work isn't even the right word, because when you're passionate about something, it becomes sort of an obsession.
Yeah.
But you were talking about, you know, writing for 12, 13 hours a day working on your dissertation.
Yeah.
How do we continue, or how do we do a better job of communicating to our students that, yes, you know, there is this probability of success for you, and we will bet on you that you can do it, yeah, but it's going to take this amount of work?
I think there's a basic equation here. I mean, creativity happens after you finish your job, your regular job. So if you say, I'm just going to do what everyone else does, then guess what? You don't get to ever be creative at your job. Because no one's going to pay you to be creative until after they see, hey, that's actually interesting.
Mm.
So almost anything that I've done that's been creative that people have paid me for has always started with my just doing it.
Mm.
So I do my regular job, and what's that thing that I would like my job to look like, or what is that role that I'd like to have in the future? I just start doing it. And the nice thing about not being paid for it is that you can screw up all over the place.
Right.
Right? Because you're just learning for free. So usually what happens in just sort of every step that I've taken, whether it's my PhD or my job in movies or my job here, is that I'll look for what I wish my job would be, and I'll just start doing it. And if I'm good at it, or if people find value in it, then at some point someone will pay me for it.
Hmm.
Interesting, yeah.
Right, but it happens after you finish your first job.
I like the fact that you said I can fail and it doesn't matter. For me, it's not money, it's curiosity. I was just having this conversation with my friend yesterday. I'm ridiculous, I'm obsessive compulsive, but not for stuff and cleanliness. I'm obsessive compulsive to know.
Mm.
I'm so curious. In fact, we laugh that I go down rabbit holes. I'll start. I mean, with music, it started, I was interested in the Beatles. And then I was like, wait, who's this John Lee Hooker fellow?
Right.
And then it's like, what the heck? Who's these jug bands? And then Nina Simone, what? And it just keeps going and going and going. But I didn't have to monetize it. So I could fail. I love that idea. We can just sort of try stuff. And if we're really interested in it, hopefully we spend more time on it.
Right.
Right? And so for me, like, even calculus, I'm excited by it today. It's weird. I start talking about calculus in my class, and I'm not teaching calculus. I'm teaching methods, and my students don't even sometimes pass intro math. But I get excited about it, and they get excited. And, well, how are we going to bridge that? How is your excitement going to actually get you to understanding it?
Right.
It's the hours.
The hours that you put into it.
Hours.
So do you have that explicit conversation with your students about how much work it's going to be?
I do.
Yeah.
And in fact, oftentimes when they're challenging, I'll just stop the class and say, look, I'll call something like Google Scholar up and show them my articles and show all the countries
mm-hmm.
that are acknowledging my scholarship. Like, this isn't just someone saying, hey, cool, you did a good job. Here's $20.
Right.
Right? I got a note from Scotland. Who gets notes from a country? I got a note from Hong Kong. Like, these are like, thank you for your amazing scholarship. We just saved 20 music programs. This is the stuff that I didn't think it was going to happen. The work I was doing, I never saw that as the end game.
Mm.
I didn't know. So for me, it was just how do we remind them that they have to put in the hours?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the end game.
Right.
You don't win the race by just standing around talking about the race.
Right.
You've got to dig in. And again, if you don't know math, you're in college. Now is the time to learn it.
Right.
That's it. And if it doesn't take 10 minutes, maybe it takes 10 hours. Then you need to put in 10 hours. You want to compete with me? You might want to put in 20.
Right.
Because I'm not done. I think it was Michael Hampton from Funkadelic, Parliament Funkadelic, said, just remember, when you're not practicing guitar, somebody else is.
Yeah.
That woke me up.
And I think for me, too, when I look at musicians, comedians, scientists, mathematicians, there's this three or four year stretch where you have to be obsessed for 3 or 4 years at whatever that thing it is that you care, whatever your field is. If you are obsessed for 3 or 4 years where you just, all I do is just work on this, I want to be great at this, you can be world class at that. Maintenance doesn't take a long time.
Yeah.
right? Mm. Yeah. Once you have that 3-4 year commitment, now you hear Patton Oswalt talk about it, you hear Louis C.K. talk about it, you hear about musicians talk about it. I have a professional drummer in my class. He goes, yeah, there's a 3-4 year period of my life where I practiced 10 hours every day, and if I did 9, I did 11 the next day. Like, you yeah. have to have that sort of moment in your life where you said, this is the time where I'm going to be great.
Right.
Yeah. And if you make that commitment, you're there.
Yeah.
And staying there, it's not that much work.
That's it. And they say 10 years of something and you're an expert.
Yeah, that 10,000 hour rule is that particular type of 10,000 hours in the practice, the particular, you know, focus practice.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Right. And it's not like those 10,000 steps a day where you're going to get a little stupid eye watch and it's going to clock you. It's like you've got to be on top of that. And again, I think it's the passion or the drive. I mean, mine is passion. Some people are driven for other reasons. I don't think there's only one path to this.
Well, you know, I worked with one of the best people in my field. And when I just saw him work, like how he worked, like how he, when he read, what he read, what he didn't read, what he skipped, just his professional, this week, this is what I'm doing, and I'm going to try to find something new. And just, you know, to see someone creative say, what is my daily discipline to actually have that creative spark? And to be able to see that, it's life-changing.
Yeah.
Because then you go, oh, it's a thing that I work at.
Yeah.
It's not a thing that I'm born with. That it comes because my habits week to week to week are exactly the same. That I do the same thing and it leads me to a creative spark.
And being able to see that as a student, to see another person do that, and it kind of speaks to the apprenticeship model that you were talking about, Darby, is so empowering, but oftentimes something that so few people have the opportunity to actually experience that. Because we do know that people are social creatures. I mean, our ability for social intelligence to be able to learn from others is to some extent, what some folks would argue, sets us aside from all other beings, all
That's
other
right.
creatures, right?
That's
it's
right.
that social component of being able to learn. So just being exposed to that, seeing what someone's, you know, patterns are, how they're approaching things, and all of a sudden that becomes part of something that I can do.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
is incredible. If we can find more ways to help share those experiences with students. And I know that you've talked about it before, John, with internships and the work that you're doing in your classroom. Mm-hmm. Darby certainly mm-hmm. speaks to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're coming up to the end of our time here. So, Dr. Southgate, when students want to find you, faculty want to find you, two sides of you that are complementary. So if they're looking for you on campus or want to talk sociology with you, how do they find you? And then if people want to find out more about your music and what you're doing with that, where do they go?
Sure. You could contact me here at LAVC. My email is southgde@lavc.edu. I'm also on Facebook. I know we're not big fans of Facebook these days, but, you know, I don't really share a lot of personal stuff. You can't go looking through my friends because they're all pretty famous. So we'll just keep that on the low key, but you're more than welcome to contact me via there. I think it's a great place for us to sort of meet up.
Great.
Well, thank you very much. That was wonderful.
Thank you so much for sharing with us and being here, Darby.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
All right, guys. Thanks.